good to be with you today. So the title of my talk is Whole Grain Potato Chips and Guilt-Free Jell-O, Writing About Food Production. Today I want to talk about how critical pedagogy and a transnational lens can together offer insight into some of the arguments about food production circulating around us, as Maxwell has demonstrated, and how these together can enrich our composition pedagogy, moving us toward a critical food literacy. And here I'm defining a critical food literacy as the ability to identify and analyze dominant discourses about food production, as well as the ability to construct arguments that respond to the economic and political structures behind these discourses. And we don't need to watch TV very long these days to learn that, according to the experts, high fructose corn syrup is all natural, and that 99% of California dairy farms are family-owned. Magazines such as People advertise multigrain Pringles. Grocery stores celebrate MSG-free taco seasoning. What is not so clear, though, is how the products being marketed with words like all-natural, family-owned, multigrain, or MSG-free are qualitatively different from their alternatives. But more importantly, what investigative journalists such as Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser and others have brought to light in the last few years is how difficult it can be to determine the reality behind this wholesome-sounding rhetoric. In fact, they would argue that economic and legal structures have systematically placed a veil over our current processes of industrialized food production. In other words, they would say our confusion about the differences between food-labeled organic or natural is no accident, and that a hamburger is cheaper than a head of broccoli not because of a free marketplace, but because of a rigged marketplace, because of collusion between big business and government at the expense of consumers, not to mention farmers, farm workers, laborers throughout the food production chain, and the environment. Now recently, John Shilp called the field of rhetoric and composition to attend to issues of sovereignty. He defines sovereignty as the exercise of authority by a nation state or another sort of regime, not only with respect to its own people, but also in relation to similar polities. So in response to Shilp's call, today I want to talk about how as rhetoricians and compositionists, we can attend to this exercise of authority in the ways our food is grown, processed, and marketed. And to do this, we might ask questions such as, how is our discourse about food constructed? What are the economic stakes in the dominant narratives? Which voices tend to be privileged and which tend to be silenced? And inviting our students to ask these questions also aligns with the Freirean concept of critical pedagogy because it places them squarely in the middle of the social problems associated with our food production system. In this way, students find themselves, as we all do, both implicated in the problems and responsible for finding solutions as well. But not only do we need to think about how we as Americans are affected by these policies, but also how people geographically distant from us are affected as well. And here I'm particularly thinking of the ways that US citizens disproportionately benefit from the global north's dominance in so-called free trade agreements. In other words, what is our privilege blinding us to? A transnational lens is helpful in addressing these questions because it draws attention to the movements of people, culture, commerce, and technology across borders in the context of globalization. Helping us link discourses of sovereignty to their material implications and inviting students to critically analyze subtle power relationships in the production and consumption of food. A critical transnational pedagogy explores the many streams of knowledge, power, discourse, and material circumstances that intersect at a given site, revealing its relationship to larger systems as well. This pedagogical focus provides a context for students to go beyond their identities as consumers to also consider their responsibilities as citizens in evaluating the effects of public policies. Of course, this may all be good in theory, you might say, but what does it look like in the classroom? So I'm going to spend the rest of my presentation outlining in broad strokes what a critical food literacy might look like in a composition classroom, and incidentally, a composition classroom at one of the land-grant universities that Maxwell mentioned earlier, University of Missouri. So when I teach with this approach, I divide the semester into three units with one major paper per unit. Each unit has a different focus, but they build upon each other. So for example, in the first unit, we analyze food advertisements. In the second unit, we comparatively analyze two texts about food crops. And in the third, we research a particular food production issue. And this information is on the handout as well. If you didn't get one, I'll be happy to share one with you. Throughout the first two units, we also watch the documentary Food Inc. And in the third unit, we watch the documentary Fresh. These documentaries feature many of the people and places referenced in the text students are reading. I find that these work together well because while the texts offer a more thorough analysis of the context and policies than is possible in a film, the documentaries bring these same people and places to life. So in the first unit, we focus on learning the tools and vocabulary students need in order to analyze a visual text. The students are asked to do more than merely analyze an ad, but also to apply that analysis to make an argument about what the ad can tell us about how Americans value and consume food. So I'd like to walk through the premises of this assignment. So how long does it take, how long do you typically take to read an ad? A few seconds?
Yeah.
In fact, more than likely, no longer than it takes to turn the page, right? And of course, ad writers know this. They know they only have a few seconds to grab our attention, and they do this largely by affective appeals, by appealing to our gut instincts, to our assumptions, our prejudices, our preferences, our neural pathways, if you will. So if we can imagine an ad as a societal mirror of sorts, it can begin to show us something about our fears, our desires, our values that we might not be immediately conscious of. And here's some examples. The ad on the left is from a February 2010 issue of Us Weekly. The ad on the right appeared in Men's Health the same week. And given that information, it's not too hard to deduce the intended audiences. The Jell-O ad with its whimsical font is directed at women. The Campbell's Chunky ad with its bold block letters to men. What I find astonishing is the contrast in what the ads are offering us. Nothing versus 100%. Now, it's important to note that these absolute terms merit some critique as well. The fine print on the Jell-O ad emphasizes that this sugar-free snack is zero Weight Watchers points. Even the finer print reveals that it actually does have 10 calories. And the Campbell's Chunky Soup, well, there may be no fat in this 100% lean meat, but that doesn't mean that that meat is any larger than, say, the tip of a finger, right? It could be very, very small. But these ads tell us something about the gendered way people value and consume food. According to the Jell-O ad, women can be lured into giving up cold, hard cash for, well, nothing. On the flip side, the Campbell's Chunky ad represents a masculinity that demands absolute satisfaction and quality. These ads suggest, then, I would argue, that one of the ways we value and consume food may have less to do with the nutritional content of the food than desiring and fulfilling particular visions of femininity and masculinity. And here are a few more examples. A Cargill ad like this might tell us something about the role nostalgia plays in our food choices. This Monsanto ad, and incidentally this company is headquartered here in St. Louis, also has a nostalgic appeal and also plays to our conception of the traditional self-made entrepreneurial independent farmer. However, some would argue that by using Monsanto's advanced farming practices that this ad is advocating for, it also plays to our conception of the some would argue that by using Monsanto's advanced farming practices, this farmer is highly unlikely to be that traditional independent farmer, but actually deeply in debt. His farming choice is severely limited by multinational corporations, legally protected, but ethically questionable practices. Now in the second unit, students comparatively analyzed two articles about food crops in order to show what new insight can be gained by placing the two texts together. And to do this, they choose from a pool of selected articles, actually the book chapters, from authors discussing the way crops are raised for food, and these titles are listed in the bibliography on your handout. The range of writing and rhetorical styles of these selections provides an opening to discuss the relative effectiveness of, for example, a journalistic narrative versus a text-based on empirical studies and statistical data. And here students find that both types of appeals can be quite seductive, whether they have the veneer of objectivity or not. Therefore, students will research the evidence and claims made by these writers in order to determine how they hold up to closer scrutiny. Of course, it's my hope that students will make several discoveries along the way. First of all, this process of comparing these pairs of texts gives them new insight into the slipperiness of terms like organic and sustainable and arguments made on their behalf. Furthermore, they see that these texts are involved in a Burkean parlor rather than a tete-a-tete. For example, while there's a critique of conventional farming, there are also multiple critiques of the different approaches that all fall under the organic farming label. These discoveries then propel students to the third and final unit, where they research a policy issue, generally one related to how animals are raised and processed for food. However, in order to avoid papers that deal with these issues as mere abstractions, students situate the issues in relation to a local community, either their own home community or one in the state of Missouri. They may either focus on a problem in a given location, and in Missouri, CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, are a significant issue for many local communities. Or they might focus on innovative alternatives, such as humanely raised pork co-ops, or CSAs, community-supported agriculture, that may serve as models for other communities. In this process, students begin to see both the urgency in finding solutions to our current dilemmas, but also the barriers, whether they come in the form of corporate monopolies or legislative action or inaction, as the case may be. Furthermore, they learn, they consider the unintended consequences that accompany every new solution. They see the inextricable links between the global and the local. For example, how U.S. farm subsidies flood the Mexican market with cheap corn, putting Mexican farmers out of business. In turn, many of these disaffected farmers are recruited by U.S. meat packers. Upon their arrival in the U.S., they are then classified as criminals for their undocumented status, subject to arrest and imprisonment, and blamed for taking jobs from Americans. Ultimately, my goal is that students will see how the environmental, economic, and public health costs of our current food production systems position us at a threshold of both opportunity and crisis. Governmental and economic policies play often hidden but crucial roles in determining the choices available to consumers, farmers, and laborers. Students are invited to engage with the many voices that speak to a given issue, embrace complexity, pushing beyond pro-con debate to meaningful problem solving. Thank you.